When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, everybody. Today's guest is my good friend, Jarrett Reddick, lead vocalist, guitarist, and songwriter for the Wichita Falls, Texas punk rock band, Bowling for Soup. Together, we break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the smash hit Grammy-nominated single, Girl All the Bad Guys Want, taken from their 2002 album, Drunk Enough to Dance. Jarrett is the primary songwriter in Bowling for Soup, and this was the first song he had ever co-written with somebody else. That somebody being producer Butch Walker. The band already had the record recorded, and at the very last minute, the label asked Jarrett if he'd be open to hearing a song idea that Butch had. Jarrett enthusiastically agreed, and the rest is, well, history. Not just for Bowling for Soup, but also for Butch Walker. This song was a pivotal point in both of their careers. Bowling for Soup is still out there killing it year after year, and Butch, well, he's no stranger to success, having worked with the likes of Avril Lavigne, Green Day, and Weezer. Oh, and the laughs and fun these guys had making this song, it should be criminal. To hear all about it and a whole lot more, don't touch that dial, or I may just revoke your season pass to the racetrack.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Jarrett, my man, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. I don't know if I've ever told you this. I don't know how you do everything in a 24-hour span. Now, I'm assuming you sleep 6 to 7, maybe 8 hours. I don't know if you're lucky you get 8 hours. I don't get 8 a night. But you're one of the hardest working men in rock and roll. And I mean that with all my heart, not just as your friend. So thank you for sitting in with us and making some time this morning.
No, thank you. Yeah, I mean, the thing about me is I don't have any hobbies, because doing what we do for work is what I love to do. And so
yeah,
if it's not spending time with my family or, you know, taking care of something that I absolutely need to, then I'm doing something that to most people, you know, seems like I'm working, but I just love it.
I feel the same exact way, and I can share that sentiment. I wouldn't have time for a bowling league, or if I had buddies that wanted to go golfing, or I just wouldn't have time. And all my time is spent with either my family or what we love to do, what I love to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I admittedly will play golf, you know, 4 or 5 times, probably 3 or 4 now times a year. but even that, you know, I mean, it's with Gary, our drummer, and we're talking about work, you know, the whole time. And so,
yeah.
But, you know, again, it's, you know, making people smile and being creative and all of that. I mean, this TikTok thing, man, I mean, it's like it was just handmade for me, you know, because it's just what I love to do. And I can get on there and I can be silly or talk about mental health, or I can play a song or what. It's just, those are all the things that I love to do. So yeah, man, I stay busy, but I'm happy to be here, man. I'm glad. I was one of your first episodes, I think. And so
you were episode number 2. So you are a repeat guest, and this is awesome. And you know, going back on the timeline, for some reason, okay, I was under the impression that the track we're going to talk about today, Girl All the Bad Guys Want, I thought this was on the next record with 85, but it was on Drunk Enough to Dance. And, you know, this song, I mean, 85 just eclipsed everything because it was so massive, but let's not for a second take anything away from this track. This song was huge. In fact, when you play it live and I look out, to me, there's nights it gets as good or a better reaction than 85.
This song is a lot of firsts for us. This is definitely the song that I would say, you know, for lack of a better term, broke us. You know, we had done Let's Do It for Johnny. The Bitch Song was the single, and that record did not do all that well, but it started our career in the UK. And then when this record came out, you know, we were still considered a quote unquote rock band. This came out in 2002, Drunk Enough to Dance.
Yeah.
And so they were working us to rock radio with little success. And then a pop station, David Edgar is the name of the PD in Indianapolis, put it under Radio Now, I believe it was called, and put it into power rotation over the Christmas break, which us industry people know, if you go on radio over the Christmas break, it's 4 to 6 weeks of that same schedule because they all go on vacation. So there's no like additional reporting or anything. So when everyone came back from that Christmas vacation, people are like, what is going on with this song? Well, and then the Grammy nomination happened. And so all of a sudden, all at once, this song, we're Grammy nominated. This song crosses over into pop radio, which is a completely different world for us.
Sure.
And it changed everything. You know, we went from, honestly, we didn't go from van to airplane because we were just doing radio shows for a little over a year, which is worse, as you know. Like,
oh, gosh.
People are like, oh, man, airplane, that sounds great. No, it's the worst because, you know, your hours are, you know, you're up at 4 a.m. to fly somewhere to have nothing to do until 8. And then, you know, it's just, you know, it's brutal. But yeah, a lot of firsts. And sorry to keep going on this one, but the other first this is, Chris, this is my very first co-write.
Oh, geez.
So I had never co-written a song. Never.
And real quick with that, it was with Butch Walker, who's been a previous guest here on the show. And I've loved Butch since I first heard of him in South Gang years ago. I've always loved his writing and his production is fantastic. A couple things. How did the meeting come up with Butch? How was that presented to you from Jive Records? And two-part question. In hindsight, looking back, I know you said it did okay for you and the UK kind of opened things up for you there, but were there any hits on Let's Do It for Johnny for you? You thought could have crossed over to American radio?
So I'll do it backwards. So Let's Do It for Johnny. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think that we could have probably given it a better effort. There was a few songs, you know, when we got signed to that deal in 1999, you know, the Bitch Song was definitely leading the charge. But, you know, for us, there was a little bit more substance to what we were doing. You know, I think Pictures He Drew on that record could have done something. Everybody liked this song, Dance With You. Although Dance With You is one of those weird songs. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this or not, but like we recorded that for an album. And then when we went in to do it for Let's Do It for Johnny to re-record it, we didn't recapture it. Like it's not as good. And there is something about that, you know, and it's, you know, some of us call it demo-itis, but it's bigger than that. Like sometimes you just can't recapture that magic. So, yeah, I think that there were definitely some songs had we been given another chance. I mean, even Sucker Punch, I think, could have done something. But it's because everything was catching on in the UK that they sort of were like, hey, we need to go do another record and sort of like restart this process. So when you're on a major label and they're pushing you to do that second record, because your goal is to get to the third record, you know, because it's like if you can get past that second one, you get into the third one, then you actually start to get real budgets. And, you know, and their commitment becomes a little bit like, you know, okay, well, we're going to have to fulfill this entire deal.
Were you guarded about Butch? What was that like? Because, I mean, you're the sole writer on all these songs. Yeah. You look at the record, everything says Reddick, except for the co-write with Butch. So what did that do to you as a younger songwriter?
Well, you know, I was open to whatever. And so Butch came in as the producer first. And so honestly, you know, much like you, you know, we're metal kids. And I knew who he was. I knew who Marvelous 3 was. I knew who South Gang was. I loved the Marvelous 3 hit, you know, and I'd seen them live, and there's just not a better live band than Marvelous 3. I mean, they're just not, you know, I mean, they're just so good. And he's such an entertainer, and you know, I just knew, you know, and so he at the time was a young producer that was getting into some stuff. He had done a Lit record and a Stroke 9 record. You know, I mean, this was, he was just sort of dipping his foot in. So as for, it started out as a producer. I'll never forget this. I was on the phone with him. I was walking around, pacing around my apartment. And I'm talking to him and, you know, and he goes, okay, you just send me the songs. I like them. I sent him 17 songs. And he's like, yeah, I like all these. He goes, you know, I work a little bit different. You know, we kind of fast forward. We're going to get through the drums. We're going to do this. When we get to guitar and things like that, listen, if we get stuck, I'm just going to grab the guitar and play it for you. Cause I'm really good. And I was just like, okay. Yeah. I mean, all right. And so that's really the first thing that ego wise, you know, I never really had an ego per se, but that's the first thing I really had to learn was that, like, hey, we're all in this together. And if he can save us, you know, 40 minutes by just grabbing this guitar and just playing this part, I'm going to freaking let him.
Also, it kind of made you, in a way, step up your game. Here's a guy kind of laying down the gauntlet a little bit, like, hey, partner, we're going for this.
Yeah, we're doing this and we have a limited amount of time. And, you know, I got to do this. So back to the, When I told the guys, I'm like, hey, you know, this guy's going to produce our record. And I just put Ready, Sex, Go on. And it just starts with that, yeah, 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 you know. I can dish it out, but you know I can't take it. Well, you told me every time that you came that you were faking. So I guess I'll never know. You know, I can dish it out, but you know, I can't take it when the talking about the five and never know. And they're just like, what? They're like, this is the greatest thing we've ever heard. And so we were excited going in. And so to lead into how the co-write happened, we were going to write a song. So I went in a day early. And honestly, he just picked me up in his car and took me to watch him get a haircut at his sister's house. And we went and got some food. And
don't tell me that's the inspiration for this song.
We just drank beers and we never wrote a song. But what we had done was we had started this dialogue about, and this will give you a little insight into the video. We had started this dialogue about what was going on in music and the singers that were mad at their dads, which is a vocal, which is a line that we end up using. And so our goal in this was if we do write a song, let's write a song about, you know, all of these guys that are so mad at their dads, you know, this mad at dad rock that's happening right now. And you know, the thing is, you know how I am and you know me as a person, I would never like take an actual, you know, like a shot at somebody, but I will definitely observe what is happening and comment on it.
Sure.
And so, you know, that was what was on the radio, on MTV was, you know, Stained and Limp Bizkit and, you know, all of these Disturbed and these bands like that were just like, you know, I mean, Stained obviously being the ones that we took the biggest shot at and sort of to me being the poster child of all that. But yeah, that's the way that it came out. So to get to the song, we recorded the whole album. And then my A&R guy calls me and he goes, hey, Butch wants you to come in the studio early today because he wants you to listen to this idea that he's got. And I'm like, okay. What I didn't realize is that, you know, at the level that he was on, it was more than just going, hey, let's me and you write a song. Like his manager, like made the deal, you know, like, okay, if Butch is going to write a song, this is how it's going to go. And you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're going to own this percentage of it just to make sure that before we even walked in that room, everything was good. He was being protected already.
Well, and remember, he's trying to build a career. And this exactly. led to writing songs for Avril Lavigne and everything that came after it. So this was building something for him as well.
This was honestly, this record, you know, was yeah, before next thing you know, All American Rejects and, you know, Simple Plan, Good Charlotte, everybody's going through his door. And then, of course, the Avril Lavigne thing happens and they hit it off and you know, the rest is history. He sure. does, you know, Pink and whoever he wants now. I mean, he's done a Weezer, Green Day, Frank Turner now. Like it's just bonkers what he has done. And you know what? He's that good. I mean, I can just tell you, he's that good. You know, as a producer, what he does is, you know, that was my thing is I was worried about working with a producer because I'd never worked with an outside producer before. And I thought, man, he's just going to come in here and change all my shit. And like, I don't know how I'm going to feel about that because I've never had that before. And that's not what happened. He came and he would change one line and you'd go, oh, okay. Well, that makes it. He'd be, you know what? Like Emily, we had an intro to that song. He was like, oh man, let's just go into it. Like, yeah, it wasn't supposed to be like this. And you're just like, oh my God. And then that drum hits in and you're just like, ah. And you know, little things like that was what he was doing with us.
Do you know what I found, Jared, when I first opened my mind to working with a producer was that when the producer would tell me that my guitar part wasn't fitting the song, I would sit back, take a deep breath, swallow, kind of analyze and think about what he was saying. However, if Roger or somebody else said it, I'd be angry.
Right.
You know, having that extra set of eyes in there, and then all of a sudden they change one word and you go, wow, my song is better.
You know what? I have such an interesting relationship with my band that I can sort of just do that, you know, but I will say, you know, at that time, you know, we were so young and stuff. I think had I micromanaged Gary through that record or even the next record, you know, it probably wouldn't have been as smooth as what it was before or even today.
Yeah.
And it was sort of nice to have that, you know, and we still have that in that, like, Linus of Hollywood will normally do Gary's drums and then the bass and stuff like that. So it's not, you know, daddy, as they call me, just standing over them, you know, oh, one more thing he's going to micromanage. And you're so right. In that, but yeah, that was the thing, is that he was able to really, really get those guys clicking on all cylinders, and something that we really hadn't done before, to make sure that what Gary and Eric were playing were really adding to the song, to making sure that the rhythm that was being put down for us to play to was absolutely on every single song. And he certainly accomplished that.
Well, before we jump into the song, I got one more thing. The song was nominated for a Grammy in 2003 in the Best Pop Performance by a Duo or a Group with Vocal category. And I had read, and you know, how many late nights have I had with you telling crazy stories? I've never heard this, but evidently Joan Rivers said you had the worst outfit at the Grammys that year. Can you expound on this?
Not only that,
Joan Rivers?
Walking by, and you know, at that point, you know, we were all skinny except Chris, and she's like live on the thing, and she on her show just goes, look at this fatty over here, and she's like points to Chris, and then Jimmy Kimmel points them out in the crowd and goes, here's the biggest guy with the smallest head, and like we were just, our outfits just really took over for us, and yes, we got worst dressed.
Yes.
Do the show Best and Worst Dressed, and then People Magazine did a whole thing on it. So that was the deal. What I would tell everybody was so funny about that was, you know, it's when our grandparents finally, we could tell, you know, our grandparents figured out what we were doing was because they were at the beauty shop and we were in People Magazine for our outfits at the Grammys, you know, and they were just like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is just what they do now. You know, they're not just driving around, you know.
This looks legit. Joan Rivers is talking about my grandson.
Joan Rivers, worst dressed. Yeah. And so that was a big plus for us. We wore that like a badge. And
I would have wore it like a badge too. Well, the song's 3 minutes and 18 seconds, Jared. The intro, the first four bars, guitar is centered, playing the main hook riff. So catchy. On bar five, we get a stereo guitar slide in, followed by eight more bars of drums, bass, and stereo guitars. And that guitar centered is going all the way through as well, just hitting you with that hook. A 16th note tambourine also joins the party here when the band kicks in. "8 o'clock, Monday night, and I'm waiting to finally talk to a girl a little cooler than me. Her name is Nona. She's a rocker with a nose ring. She wears a two-way, but I'm not quite sure what that means." What is going on?
It's the funniest thing, because that is probably the biggest question that I get. Probably the biggest question that I get besides, how'd you get the name of the band, or are you bowling to earn soup or to support it or whatever? The biggest question I get is, what the hell is a two-way? And, you know, it's funny because when you have that conversation and it's like, you know, what we meant by it, of course, there's innuendo in that, but it's a pager, you know, but the thing is that, you know, a two-way pager, but some people would call it a two-way. And so, you know, it sounded dirty. So yeah. When we put that in the song, you know, never did we think that, you know, 20 something years later, would we have, you know, so still literally, I just did a TikTok about this the other day.
You know, by 2002, people were, you know, I had a cell phone by then. I mean, a pager is kind of outdated here. Were you kind of being ironic with yourselves with that lyric? How it's very strange.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was the point, was it just like, this sounds dirty. Basically, it was like, and it also made her, we're trying to make ourselves even less cool. I mean, that was the point of, like, you know, she's a rocker with a nose ring. She's a little cooler than me, you know, like this guy doesn't even know what a pager is. And, you know, at that point we were all getting cell phones, you know,
even the name Nona, you could have picked any names. It's a two syllable name. Why Nona? Nona sounds like your great aunt or your grandma's name. It's an old fashioned name kind of.
Yeah. It was Butch's dog's name. And it just, you know, it's sort of like one of those names from the past, like Lola, Nona, you know, those kind of like just sing-songy sort of 60s names, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
To me, it made her look cooler. You know, it made her look like she's more with it kind of thing.
And I'm going to ask you as we comb through the tune here, but up to this point, verse one, the intro, anything changed from the initial song? And did you guys ever record a demo for this?
Never recorded a demo. This thing.
No, because it was too late in the recording process, right?
Too late. We were done with the record. We were absolutely done. And so I gotta say, you know, that when I heard that guitar riff, first of all, I didn't even know what drop D was. And so when I heard him play that just on, it wasn't even on an acoustic. We recorded this record in like a storage facility. So like, it's hard to explain, but like you went in and like he had like a warehouse and then a second warehouse with a window in it. And like he had put carpet in there and, you know, but it was nothing fancy, but it was, you know, Butch fancy because everything he does is awesome. And so, you know, you just had all the amps, all the amp heads were in there and the speakers were in the other room and he had it wired up and he played me the riff. And I was just like, oh my God, that's freaking amazing. I'm like, I don't even know how you do that. And he goes, well, this is drop D tuning. And, you know, I'm just like, yeah, okay. I don't know what that is either. You know, and he's just like, well, you tune this string to this. And then, and Chris is, you know, later on, I said, Chris is like, man, you know what that is. That's that Marilyn Manson riff that we mess around with all the time. You know, the da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na. But yeah, man, just to me, that guitar riff is such a big part of the hook.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like people hear the first two notes and they lose their minds, as you said.
That's how the song starts. Yeah.
Yeah. The way that he recorded it too. So he played that, but we did it with a baritone guitar and we did it with two amps, and it's just like the combination of all that. But yeah, I'm sorry. I think I got off the question.
No, that's fine. Baritone guitars are killer. They just give this, it's just like I can't even describe it. It's just such a cool, thick sound. Verse one, drum, stereo guitars, and it sounds like there's like some, what I call hair on the bass. It's a little distorted. It's
absolutely
got this, it is really mean sounding, and I don't recall that from just casually listening to this track, but really getting into it, I was like, wow, that bass is really dirty. The tone is killer. And the stereo guitars are playing what I'm calling loose eighth note palm mutes. There's a lot of feel here. It's not really locked on either side. How important was that with Butch? Do you recall? Because a lot of times you want them to be fully locked. Like it's, I don't know, Metallica or something. They got to be completely locked for this particular song. But for this, I think if they would have been locked, it would have been sterile.
This is when we first started doing this. This is Butch's production. This whole record is like that. It's me on both sides, and then sometimes Butch on both sides, and Chris up the middle. And so Chris will come in. Chris plays real thick. And so he will thicken up the choruses and the bridges and things like that. But most of the tight stuff, this is where I started using more of a plexi sound, all because of Butch, and like way less distortion so that it would sound tighter, but you still wanted it to sound like there's two guys playing. this is the way we recorded after this for years and years and years. We've sort of broken this a little bit, but it, but still for the most part, if I'm the one that's recording us, it's two of me and one of him up the middle. And that's, you know, it's still, that's the Bowling for Soup sound.
Yeah. Well, I like it. Like I said, it's loose. It's tight in the band sense for a recording, but there's still a little push and pull. I like how it breathes there. And yeah. Now the song just starts getting weird here. Okay. It just does. I'm calling this the pre-chorus one setup, the next three lines. Sure what that means. And when she walks, all the windows and the angels see. She doesn't notice me. Cause she's watching. And when she walks, all the wind blows and the angels sing. She doesn't notice me. Like,
right.
After that, that's where the chorus is going to come in. Oh no. Right. No. Yeah. Now we get to this long pre-chorus. We're going to get to that in a second. But we get our first harmonies here on When She Walks, on The Wind Blows and the Angels Sing. And then we get these ah-ah backing vocals between that and the next line, She Doesn't Notice Me. Really nice left and right separation with the ah backing vocals that are happening there. But what was the thought here going into the next part? Because the next part, it's like you got two choruses in this song.
Yeah, there's definitely the two chorus thing. And thanks for pointing out the ah part. That is textbook Bowling for Soup. You know, that is like, that's our shit. You know, we still do that to this day, 30 years in, you know. It's funny because even with my country band, we're throwing that on stuff and I'm taking it out as much as I'm putting it in because I'm going, God, that sounds like Bowling for Soup.
I can't do that trick.
I don't want to do that trick here. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. So I had told him, you know, it's funny because I said, I can't write those choruses where like you just say the same thing over and over. Like I've never been able to do that. You know, there's so many songs that are like that. And I'm always like, God, that is such a gift to be able to do that. To know like when that's enough of a hook to just say the same thing over and over again.
Born in the USA. We're not going to take it. You know,
exactly. I just think that's not enough. To me, this is the chorus, and I almost feel like the girl the bad guys want ends up being like a post-chorus kind of thing. But
okay, you
know,
yeah.
But I don't know. You know, I just feel like this song is literally like as you know, what's the guy from the Black Eyed Peas, the really really good producer guy, Will.i.am.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he's like every single part of the song should sound like a chorus, and I'm like, if there's any Bowling for Soup song that does that, it's Girl the Bad Guys Want.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'd make the argument that this was the chorus, but then it goes into like a B part off this pre-chorus. We'll get there right now. It's just very strange how long it takes to get to Girl All the Bad Guys Want. But when we do finally get there, Jarrett, it's only at 55 seconds. And in the weirdest way, I feel like I've been listening to a 2-minute song. It's not laborious. It's not like, oh, this song's going on forever. I couldn't believe how quick it got to the chorus with all this being thrown at you here. The pre-chorus one we were talking about, and When She Walks, that section, the stereo guitars there move to a strumming pattern. The next section here, what I'm calling pre-chorus one, the chorus setup. It's me, 'cause she's watching wrestling, creaming over tough guys, listening to rap metal, turntables. Like a bad movie, she's looking through me. If you were me, then you'd be screaming, someone shoot me. As I fell miserably, trying to get the girl all the bad guys want. 'Cause she's watching wrestling, creaming over tough guys, listening to rap metal, turntables in her eyes. It's like a bad movie. She is looking through me. If you were me, then you'd be screaming, someone shoot me. As I fail miserably, trying to get the girl all the bad guys want. The first line here, a couple interesting things, Jarrett. I've always said, and I never realized this really till getting into this show, you know, the chorus can start in many different places. It can start before the downbeat of the actual chorus. It can start right on the downbeat. It can start right after. Well, here in this pre-chorus, the first, 'cause she's watching wrestling, that's over the part before it. She doesn't notice me. Before that part ends, that line already comes in. After each line here, the first four lines up to turntables in her eyes, we get dun dun. So the band's doing these big stops. The lead vocal here sounds doubled through this whole section. Do you recall?
Oh, yeah. Double everything.
Yeah.
This might be tripled. I don't remember, but we double everything.
Okay. Well, after this dun dun part, okay, when it goes to It's Like a Bad Movie, we get harmony on that all the way through screaming Someone Shoot Me. And the last two lines, you don't get a harmony until you hear Girl All the Bad Guys Want. And the reason I pointed out that first line in the pre-chorus, because she's watching wrestling, that's over the other section. Same thing here. Before we get out of pre-chorus one, the Girl All the Bad Guys Want hits before the downbeat of when it actually comes in. After you say Girl All the Bad Guys Want, we also get a call and response with Want there. So the hook starts before the downbeat. I love that. We get harmonies on the next line because she's the girl all the bad guys want. We get the want call and response. And that guitar melody hook is all through this chorus. And when you get done saying bad guys want, we get a 4-bar basically reintro before verse 2. So a lot here in this section. When you go to It's Like a Bad Movie, the stereo guitars go back to 8th note palm mutes there. So it does these big dun dun chugs with the band, okay, which sounds like a chorus, but then it goes back down again. Very interesting.
You know, gosh, I wish I could take credit for that part. That's definitely Butch Walker. To me, I think it's one of those things where it's like you're sort of teasing at this point. Like, when are they finally going to tell us what the hell's happening here? And if you know, you get to the Gretchen. First of all, let me just say how brilliant the call and response thing is, because it's very hard to sing that song. And so that has done me very, very well, because most of the time the audience knows, so I can give them every other line, which is nice. But yeah, I feel like it drags out so long that there's this anticipation, and it almost makes you more excited when you get the payoff for Girl the Bad Guys Want.
For a poppy song that's sitting there in these 8th notes in the groove you're in, you want to talk about tension. It just keeps going. You know, looking through me, if you were me, then you'd be screaming.
That's the perfect word. There's certain songs that are just like that, and this is one of those, you know, where I feel like we... just extending that part, because we could have waited and doubled that later. But the fact that we did it on the first one, you're exactly right. It's the tension of that. It's just like, there's this just amazing buildup to when it Girl the Bad, and then it just opens up, as you said, with that riff and the band is open. And I'm like, by the way, learning to play and sing that at the same time was really fun. luckily that's just one of those autopilot things, you know, where I don't know that I could break it down for you. I just do it, you know?
Yeah,
you know,
right. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I've had people say, hey, can you show me how to play this riff? I'm like, no, I just play it.
Yeah, I just play it. I literally just sat there and like, you know, learned it. And then I'm just like, okay, my hand just does this now. I don't even, you know, I couldn't sit here and break it down for you. But
did you ever question this section with Butch and just be like, man, it's just, or did it just kind of become its own thing?
It became its own thing because we were working out those lyrics together and we were having so much fun by this point. You know, I mean, just the fact that we got creaming in a song that was on the fucking radio, dude. Like, it was
creaming over Tough Guys.
Yeah, I mean, that is so gross. But like, it is on it. That was on pop radio everywhere. There's not a pop station that didn't play this song, you know. And so
I'm picturing some lady picking up her children from the pickup, you know, parent pickup line, singing that line. You know what happened? You know what happened,
dude. This was another TikTok the other day, actually, and some girl commented, and she goes, you know, it was later in life that I had realized that, you know, from the time I was in the fifth or sixth grade, I was singing Creamin' Over Tough Guys, you know, in the car with my mom, you know, and but yeah, again, we were having, we had just made a record, so we had already been in this room together for 4 weeks, four weeks. And we had so many inside jokes by now. You know, we were bonding over the first Tenacious D record, that Big Jimmy Eat World record, you know.
Do you know what's great, though, is I think, you know, I don't know if this was genius on Butch's part that it was pre-thought of, or genius just because it kind of happened the way it did. But I think it's genius that he waited yeah. till the end. Because if he would have came at you right away, that could have might have thrown off your whole mojo. To your point, by this point, you're relaxed. You're telling jokes. You know what everyone likes to eat. Everyone's, you know, you're finishing each other's sentences, kind of.
Exactly. We're on the same plane. It's the brilliance of it. It really is. I've thought about that for 20 years, Chris. I've thought about how it's so funny.
I love that kind of stuff.
We kept talking about the fact that we would write a song or whatever, but he somehow, and I, again, I don't really feel like it was like this. I don't feel like he's like trying to keep my mind off my Christmas presents. You know, like, I don't think it's that kind of thing. I think it was just, I really do think you're right. I think he was developing that bond with me, knowing like, hey man, we're going to be able to write a way better song if we're, you know, lifetime friends by the time we do it. And, you know, mm-hmm. rather than just sit, you know, cause I do a lot of co-writes now and, you know, there are definitely the ones with inside jokes are way more fun. You and I would have a lot of fun writing a song.
Sure.
Me flying and writing a song with a stranger can be fun, but it's not going to be near, you know, all of the laughs and stuff, which we got out of this. I mean, me and Butch on this particular song can just text each other, you know, about the Trans Am or the mullet line. And just both are just crying laughing because yeah. we had so anyway, so back to your question, I didn't question it because it, to me, I was just so happy that we were getting so much substance into this. I'm a lyric guy. And so, as you said, so much happens in the first 50 seconds of this song. You have such a picture in your head.
Yeah.
You know, that we have painted you such a picture of who this girl is and what's going on. And you have so many, you know, my friend dressed up as Nona for Halloween 2 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, you can picture this girl.
Let me tell you something. How many times have I heard this song? Okay, I just heard you play it a month ago in Vegas. I sat side stage, watched you play it. I never thought it was weird until I started breaking it down. It's very different. It really is. Just everything that you go through to get to this chorus. Right off of chorus one, like I said, we get that four bar, what I'm calling a re-intro with that guitar lick, and it breaks right back down to verse two, pretty much the same instrumentation as verse one. Was this cut to Pro Tools, this record?
Yes, this is our first cut to, so our drums were recorded to tape, bass was recorded to tape, all of that was dumped, and then this is our very first record on Pro Tools. So this is, again, a lot of firsts here, Chris. Like, this is me also... I had never not recorded a tape before. So being able to record this, again, the Jarrett Reddick signature thing now, this second verse and the bridge were written in the booth. Like, we're literally talking about the lyrics as we're cutting it, you know, and that's how I do things now. I write all my songs. I finish the first verse for the most part. And I'm like, okay, I'm good to go. I'll just put that in the second verse for the demo, whatever. And then we get to the recording booth and I'm like, oh, I need 5 minutes to write this second verse.
There's something about that that pressure, that 11th hour of coming up with stuff that can be awesome. She likes the Godsmack, and I like Agent Orange. Her CD changer's full of singers that are mad at their dad.
There it is.
She says she'd like to score some reefer and a 40. She'll never know that I'm the best that she'll never have.
Yeah. See, how brilliant is that? And you know how much we were laughing about that? Because we call them the Godsmack, who sat behind us at the Grammys, by the way, and were so sweet and nice. And Shannon Larkin's my second favorite drummer of all time, next to Gary, by the way. And so I was just, you know, because you're a metal kid. We knew Wrathchild, right?
Of course, Wrathchild, yep.
Wrathchild. So,
and he played an Ugly Kid Joe, which is unbelievable.
And Amen, by the way, too.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But yeah, so... you know, we laughed so hard during all of this and just, you know, the fact that we got the Godsmack. And then I was like, man, we got to have a really cool name because like we need to put like a really, really classic punk band, and Agent Orange became that band. And funnily enough, we played with them in Dallas not too long after that. And then we've met them since and they're very appreciative of the tribute.
Hey everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more coming up with Jarrett Reddick after a few words from our sponsors. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast. And now back to the show.
Will we get a harmony on Best That She'll Never Have at the end of verse 2? Pre-chorus 2 setup, and when she walks, all the wind blows and the angels sing, she'll never notice me. Same lyric as the first time, same harmonies and those ah-ah backing vocals, pretty much the same instrumentation as the first pre-chorus 1 setup. And then, Jarrett, as if the pre-chorus 1 section wasn't long enough, we've decided to add 4 bars here. Now it's even longer before you get to Girl All the Bad Guys Want Again. And when she walks, all the wind blows and the angels sing, she'll never notice me. She's watching wrestling, creaming over tough guys, listening to rap metal, turntables in her eyes. She likes them with a mustache, racetrack season pass, driving in a Trans Am, does them all, it make a mess. It's like a bad movie, she's looking. The first 4 are the same because she's watching wrestling, creaming over tough guys, listening to rap metal, turntables in her eyes, and we get those same dun-dun, the band stopping after each line. Then we hit him with this. She likes him with a mustache, racetrack season pass, driving in a Trans Am, does a mullet make a man, and we'll wait till get through the next couple lines here. At she likes him with a mustache, the band is back in, and we get an extra 4 bars here that I just mentioned. Guitars go back to the 8th note chug, but with accents this time on the and. Mm-hmm. And it's so cool, that accent gives the whole part an urgency that pre-chorus 1 didn't have, and pre-chorus 1 already had that sense of urgency. Really cool there. Then the last lines here, same harmonies and same lyrics. It's like a bad movie. She is looking through me. If you were me, then you'd be screaming, someone shoot me as I fail miserably, trying to get the girl all the bad guys want. Those ah-ahs are here again. Again, I love that left and right separation that happens there. This section, why add those extra lines? She likes him with a mustache on down. Felt you needed more?
That was a trick that I had learned from him on this record. You know, it's that extended second pre-chorus, which Bowling for Soup fans are now super used to because I do it all the time now. But I had never really, I didn't know that trick. And then I learned that trick from him. And so it was honestly, it was to get some more funny shit in there. And I'll never forget when I said racetrack season pass, like how and then does a mullet make a man? Like, he's crying on the soundboard, you know, and I'm in the booth, as I said, like I'm singing this as I go. And so like, I'm having trouble getting through the lines.
I imagine they do season passes to races. I've never gone, but I imagine they do.
I'm sure they do. I don't know, but I
want to go to a race with you now.
Yeah. That whole line, you know, racetrack season pass, driving a Trans Am, little tribute to my brother and his Trans Am from the 80s. And then, but you know, does a mullet make a man? I feel like we could have, we should have actually capitalized that over the last few years when the mullet came back and done a, does a mullet make a man Bollinger Soup shirt.
Well, I got to tell you a couple things. You know, you talked about that baritone guitar earlier, and in my notes, I had, you know, and it makes sense now that baritone does give that, I've always thought it kind of sounds like in a mix, like a low notes on a piano. And that's what I thought was being ghosted there. But that makes sense that that's, I just wanted to bring that up. But on It's Like a Bad Movie here in pre-chorus two, a new guitar arpeggiated part is right up the middle. Kind of has a sparkly quality to it. I kept listening, it almost sounds like a 12 string, but I don't think it is.
It just has an effect on it. This is where the punk rock of Bowling for Soup starts to go, oh, okay. So this is where, like, you're going to see production-wise over the next three records, us doing way more of the ear candy stuff. Candy for the Kids kind of stuff, where it's really just for the ear of that one of those listeners like you who are really, really breaking it down. It's a texture thing. We do it vocally. We do it with instruments. There is so much shit on our songs now. And this record opened us up to that with Butch and his production, a big, big thing he had added to us, because up until this point, it was two guitars, bass, and drums, and we overdubbed the solos and we sang, you know?
Yeah,
and
called it a day. That was it. You didn't think about octaves or...
No, yeah. And so here, you know, we're really, really learning of like how the layers of how things need to build too. And, you know, I don't know, we'll talk about this as we get to the end of the song, but remind me to talk about the kitchen sink, because all of these things are, it's like a Broadway play, how they, all of the songs sort of like build on one another. And at the end, they all come out and they all melt together, you know, and that's, you're throwing in the kitchen sink. And it's so all of these layers eventually sort of all are building to a point. And so you're adding, on the second pre-chorus, the reason you're adding that is to differ it, or to differentiate it from that first one, to let them know that, okay, we're getting somewhere.
You know, it's funny. Again, how many times have I heard this song? When I got to this part, I had to go back to the first time to see if it was there.
Right.
Because it's subtle. It's not like this big part. It's just, as you called it, it's that ear candy. And I love things like that. What I'm calling chorus two is the refrain of, because she's the girl all the bad guys want. That happens three times after you say it in pre-chorus two, before the downbeat of the chorus hits. We get those want call and responses happen. And that major guitar hook of the song is running all through this. And then we go to the bridge.
There she goes again with fishnets on and dreadlocks in her hair. She broke my heart, I wanna be sedated. All I wanted was to see her naked.
I love this bridge. Stereo guitars, bass, and drums go to these double snare. It's almost like a march here.
Yeah.
Dun, dun. Dun, yeah. Dun. Very staccato and choppy. It totally feels different from the rest of the track. I think it's so awesome. We get harmonies on the first two lines. There she goes again, with fishnets on and dreadlocks in her hair. She broke my heart. I want to be sedated. All I wanted was to see her naked.
Yeah. So like a little Ramones reference there, and then the stereotypical Bowling for Soup funny line out of the broken heart line, right? I mean, we can't allow it to be too serious here. So and so, you know, you always gonna want to try to get to that point. You know, it's funny. I'm gonna go as we get into this. So that there she goes again with fishnets on and dreadlocks in her hair. So that's gonna lead into something as we do the kitchen sink. So as we get to the next part.
Oh, okay.
I'll re-reference that.
Well, a couple more things here. Again, we only get harmonies on those first two lines, from "She broke my heart" to "All I wanted was to see her naked." No harmonies there, but between "I want to be sedated" and the last line, the naked line, the band goes halftime over that whole next line, and we get those same ah-ah vocals. And that sparkly guitar from pre-chorus two comes in at the very end of the bridge here. It's so cool.
And it's beautiful too, right?
It comes out of nowhere, and you can really hear it there because it's kind of broke down. And then we get four floor tom and snare hits to take us in to pre-chorus three, which I'm calling the pre-chorus three breakdown.
Now I'm watching wrestling, trying to be a tough guy, listening
into rap metal, turntables in my eyes. I can't grow a mustache and I ain't got no season pass. All I got's a moped. It's like a bad movie, she's looking through me. If you were me, then you'd be screaming, someone shoot me. As I fail miserably, trying to give the girl all the bad guys want.
I love this because now it changes to first person. You're not talking about her. Now I am watching wrestling, trying to be a tough guy, listening to rap metal, turntables in my eyes. I can't grow a mustache, and I ain't got no season pass. All I got's a moped.
Right. Doesn't rhyme. Just like, this is just like, how uncool can you possibly make this?
I mean, at least get a used Vespa or a Lark. A moped is just...
By the time we went back to do 1985 and or that record at least, he had a Vespa. So that's all I got's a moped. Because in our mind, it's like the kind that you had to pedal. You know, first.
Right. To get it cranked.
We're going, oh my God, can you imagine? This guy is just like peddling this thing by your house, you know? And, it made for a very funny visual. Here's another thing about that part, though, is I was very sick. And so that breakdown, my voice is really, really rough. And I remember hating it, but it adds to just the desperation of it, really.
You do sound strange there.
Yeah,
and I got to tell you, I didn't want to say this. Do you remember if stuff was auto-tuned? Because there's some, I'm going to call them wrong notes. When you say trying to be, it's like flat. It's like a wrong note. But if you changed it, it wouldn't sound like this. It doesn't need to be fixed.
Right. So there is some tuning involved in it, but we don't do like the whole, like, everything's auto-tuned or whatever. You know, I mean, we do it like everybody else does it.
Right.
This man, he just left it to me for it to be my voice. And again, I didn't feel good. I mean, I was having a great time, but I was sick and you know, I'd been singing for 3 weeks. And
as a singer, that's an absolute nightmare.
I was tired. Yeah. I'm literally like, in the studio, I mean, this is a big deal because obviously the labels called me about this song and they, you know, about the idea of this song. Like, you know, I, there's some pressure here. And so I'm so glad it turned out the way it did. It drives me crazy to hear it to this day because I know, you know, oh God, it's so weird. Like my voice sounds weird, you know? So I'm glad we got to re-record it for the greatest hits, but
yeah, I've never analyzed this song going into this part. Now that you say you weren't feeling good, it sounds like you got in the mic, like, and you captured something because Butch liked it. It ended up staying.
Oh yeah.
It ended up staying. Why mess with perfection? Well, some cool things happening here. Do I hear a sequencer or like a guitar feedback from a pedal hold over from the bridge that slowly like fades in and out here? And then there's a lone guitar and piano here with a vocal until the bass guitar comes in playing single notes around I can't grow a mustache line. Am I hearing piano here?
Yes. And that's, you know, again, another one of those things that we learned from Butch on production and stuff is that, like, you can have, you know, again, we had never done that. We had never put piano on things or like B3 on things.
Well, you don't have a piano player. That was my argument early on. You know, Howard Benson's like, I want to put a keyboard on. I'm like, we don't have a keyboard. He's like, we're making a record. This isn't live. I had never heard that before. I had never heard we're making a record. This isn't you playing. You go do what you want on stage. We're making a record. It's like,
Yeah. That, I mean, it is weird to get your head around that. Especially coming from where we come from, right? Like you want to be able to recreate what it is you're doing in the studio on stage. And we pride ourselves in that. I mean, as you know, I mean, like, we play a little fast, but we pride ourselves on sounding like we sound, like being able to pull off, especially vocally, what it is we do.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, and you guys do.
Yeah, as do you. But yeah, there is something to the thing of like, hey, we're in a studio. Let's use the studio, and that this is again where we're learning that like never thought about the fact that you could have like a piano on something or whatever. And then again, this leads us down the craziest rabbit hole, because by three albums later, there's freaking keyboards on everything, there's piano on everything, you know. It's just everything, you know. Yeah. And
this is the perfect storm, perfect match with Butch. It worked 100%. out for both of you. Well, a couple other cool things here on Moped. You hear the first one, but the other two mopeds are delayed. They're like a response to that first one. I love that. And then you want to talk about a song, peaks and valleys, ebbing and flowing. You go from the bridge to this breakdown. Now you're back into a pre-chorus three, I'm calling it. It's like a bad movie. She is looking through me. If you were me, then you'd be screaming, someone shoot me as I fail miserably, trying to get the girl all the bad guys want. Back to the eighth note loose chug with the stereo guitars, and that arpeggiated overdub guitar joins us once again here. The ah-ahs at the end here, Jarrett, they're super loud.
Yeah,
at this
part.
Yeah,
we bring it all in. Man, yeah, this is the part where I want to give you a secret. So this is where we're throwing in the kitchen sink, right?
Yeah.
We're bringing in all of the different various B parts. And this is one of the beauties, again, of Pro Tools too, is that you can take parts, other sections of the song, and put them in to the end. And we do this all the time where it's like something, oh my God, that bridge melody flows over this outro. So we get to this part, and as we're writing the song and we're starting to track all the, before we're doing the vocal at the end, you know, we have that, there she goes again with fishnets on. So at the end, we just instinctively all start singing, there she goes, there she goes again. And it fits perfect. And it's all in our heads, but it's like, oh, fuck, we can't do that. You know, like, that's a whole, you know, like we could do it, but it's going to cost us a chunk.
Oh yeah, we're going to be paying some publishing for that.
Well, and we had just dealt with George Clinton on a thing for Last Rock Show, and we were just like, we were very wounded at this point. Like,
oh yeah, it's a nightmare.
So anyway, so that changed to, there she goes again. You know, so we at least hint at it. So for a long time during the live part, like Eric would sing that part or whatever, but now people just know it as being what it is. But just a funny story about how things, studio magic kind of shit, you know, where
I love that. And that was one of the, when I first got Pro Tools, it just blew my mind that you could move stuff around so easy. I mean, yeah, I could have went and sang that part over it, but hey, I'm just going to see what this sounds like. I'm going to take the pre-chorus and fly it. And you'd be amazed what it does sometimes. And it really opens your mind. Also, just being able, working with computers, something I never really discussed on this show. You know, I always felt like, prior to digital recording, that I was just kind of going down a tunnel. You know, you're looking forward. You're not looking side to side. And this opened up looking side to side on a computer screen and really, really helped me with songwriting and arranging parts, which is kind of what you were saying.
Well, I want to add to that. I think one of the things too, though, and as I mentioned this earlier, one of the things that Pro Tools does for you, not only for just adding things, it's taking things away. It's like, yes, man, should I mute that on this part or whatever? And so like, it's even when you're tracking, just be like, you can be like, yeah, go ahead and play that or go ahead and sing it. And we'll, you know, I'd rather have, Linus of Hollywood calls it footage. I'd rather have the footage, you know, like I may edit that out, but at least I want the footage. And so, big thing about Pro Tools actually, you can make a breakdown part out of a whole band part with a few clicks of the button.
Well, I think because, you know, you really only get, because she's the girl the bad guys want, you only get it four times here and twice at the top. So at the end here, you can kill it. You know, you didn't kill it before. So at the end, we get eight of them down here. On the last one, we don't get a want. It's just, she's the girl, all the bad guys, and the band goes, dun, dun, dun. Ends, and that dun 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 harkens back to when the band does it the other times in the song. So I love how it gets tied up there and on the last four lines, on lines 5 and 6, and then again on 7 and 8, it's repeated. Those are those backing vocals, there she goes again, that are held out. I couldn't figure out what you were saying there, and now I know. I love when those vocals come in there. It only happens at the very end, and it's refreshing. It's, as you said, ear candy, something new.
Cause she's the girl all the bad guys want.
we have that special ability, just like you guys, to be able to bring in a different voice because everybody in our band can sing. So like, you know, like that part obviously features Eric on the original version, and on the greatest hits, Rob sings that part. But that's another cool texture thing that we're able to do because we have, you know, our band is built around our vocals. So instead of the lead singer, so to speak, singing everything, we bring in that second singer and it's almost like a different instrument. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the fact that we were able to do that there. You know, it just so many layers.
You guys made a great record. You know you did with all these songs, but this one came in the 11th hour and it became the first single. Yeah. Do you remember first hearing it back? You know, he floored the studio monitors, cranked it up, Butch cranked it up, and you're sitting there listening going, what was your initial reaction?
So I'm going to be honest with you about this, and this is the exact same scenario that happened with 1985. That record was recorded. 1985 came in the last hour, and I still thought I had better songs. You know, like, I can't hear a hit, Chris. I can't, and it's not an ego thing.
I just thought
Emily was better. I thought Surf Colorado was a better song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing within me that thinks that anymore. I just gravitate towards what I like. And again, it's not an ego thing because I do a lot of co-writes now and sometimes they're my favorite and sometimes they're not. So what happened was, is I brought that back. I got a board mix of that song and, you know, there were a lot of people in here in my life that were excited to hear what it was we had been doing down there in Atlanta. We recorded that. I should have said this in the beginning. That's the first of the records that we recorded in Atlanta. We did three there. And not all with Butch, but we just fell in love with recording in Atlanta, Georgia. And so it was playing it for other people. It was playing it for, you know, Zach Malloy, is playing it for my friend Tim, you know, playing it for my friend Casey, you know, guys that like knew Bowling for Soup and knew where we had already been in the past that we had been down, and to show them this and like to see their reactions to it.
And they're your best friends. They're not going to blow smoke. They're going to tell you this sucks or this is great.
Yeah, and most of the time they'll just be like, okay, that's cool, you know, whatever. But when their like eyes are big and open and they're like, Jesus Christ, dude, you know, you're onto something.
Yeah.
I think it started to really sink in at the time where it's just like, man, I mean, this is it. You know, this is the path we're going down. I knew it was really cool and I knew it was great, but you know, I'd lived with these other, you know, 14 songs for so long, you know, like I just thought they were all so great, you know, but I realize how special this song is and what, you know, again, back to the first of the interview to throw it back, because that's what we do as professionals. it's just so many firsts, this song.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well,
I mean, you got invited to the Grammys. I mean, just the Joan Rivers story alone is worth the price of admission. But what doors that this opened for Butch too, that can't be understated. What it opened for you guys. I mean, it's just record making. Think about what you learned. You've said it through this whole episode.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I learned so much from that guy. I'm one of those guys. I try to learn from every experience. And I talk about co-writing a lot because I do talk to like songwriting classes or, you know, School of Rocks and things like that. And I always say, you know, like no matter who is in the room, whether they're less experienced than you or more experienced than you, there's always something to take away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but when you work with somebody like Butch Walker or Linus or those guys like that, I just try and absorb all of it. You know, I'll fucking ask a question. I try not to be overbearing, but I'm just like, what did you just do right there?
Yeah.
You know, like I want to make a mental note of that. And with Butch, his motto back then, and I don't know if he still says it, but he would just say, making records is easy and fun. And he would just say it all the time. Like he'd be like, man, isn't this great? Making records is easy and fun. And we left going, it kind of fucking is, you know, like it's that was fucking easy and fun. Like
what you make it,
but we made it, you know, and I'm super proud of that record. Drunk Enough to Dance is by far the fan favorite record, you know, mm-hmm. It's definitely, and you know, as you know, you guys, as many albums as you are in and as many albums as we are in, you always think it's your latest thing. You're like, this could compete, you know, but. And I do think that. I mean, I do think our last record is great and all that. But if you go back on the nostalgia, as you guys just did with your tour, you had to go back and listen to that record. And there has to be some part of you that when you're listening to it, you go, yeah, I kind of get it. I kind of get why this is the fan favorite.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. And I've never looked that gift horse in the eye. I've always just been very respectful of that. And I've talked to him about it a million times on this show. It's the memories with those songs. I always use the Metallica example. I don't care how good their new record is. And they got some rippers on the new album. It doesn't have 36 years of memories, 37 years of memories like Master of Puppets. It just doesn't.
That's a great way to put it, because, you know, that's just it. It's like people who are coming to see, you know, I mean, Drunk Enough to Dance now is
21. It can drink.
21. Yeah. Because Hangover turns 20 next year.
Yeah.
So, you know, 21 years of memory. So if you were just think, I mean, you know, 14, 15 year old kids, you know, are now shit, math's hard, but you know, they're almost 40 for Christ's sake.
I know.
You know, and it's like, that's a long time to have lived with these songs and had them in your life and exposed other people to them and talked to people about them and put it on at a party or put it on when you're sad. And, you know, that's a really good way to put it, is just that I never thought about that actually in that way of that, like, mm-hmm. that's 20 years of memories. You're so right. I mean, there's a reason Generator is my favorite Bad Religion record, you know, it's because I driving around in my little shitty pickup truck in Wichita Falls, Texas, going, I just need to start a punk band, you know, like,
No, I get it. It's that time. You can't replace the time. You can't replace those memories. And there's so many firsts, you know. How many times you've heard it, you know, my college girlfriend and I, we first got together listening to this song. And it's you can't compete with those memories. I've always said it. Before we break, first of all, thank you. I always ask the guest, what do you got coming up? I know what you got coming up. You got a tour with Lit. This is the only two bands in the world that decide they're just gonna tour Florida, but throw in a New Orleans play just for the heck of it.
Right. Well, you know what? So funny. We're doing the Rock Boat, and my manager came to me and was just like, hey, man, maybe you should just do like a tour leading up to that. And, I'm like, I honestly, Chris, that sounds terrible. Like, I'm going to be so hungover, you know. And then Jeremy,
before I get in the boat.
Jeremy calls me. He goes, what do you think about this? And I'm like, well, let me ask the band. And I say to the band, I think they're going to have the same opinion that I did. And Gary goes, you're saying that we can get Florida out of the way in January and not have to go there this summer? Let's fucking go. And
I'm
okey-dokey. You know, so yeah, we're on tour with Lit and the Dolly Rots in January, heading out to the Rock Boat. Then we will be in the UK with the great Less Than Jake and the Vandaliers. And then we're going to Canada for the first time in a few years in April. And then all summer long. And after, we will be celebrating 30 years of Bowling for Soup and 20 years of Hangover You Don't Deserve. And in between all of that, I will be doing country shows galore for Jarrett Ray Reddick and that project that I have. And, you know, and trying to sleep when I can, as you said earlier.
I was going to say, I don't know where you find the time. The dude has a solo country career on top of everything else that you have going on. I love it. I love you. And thank you.
I love you, brother. Thank you.
Come back to Texas. It's just not the same since you went away before you lose your accent and forget all about the Lone Star State.
Jarrett Reddick is one of the good ones, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation with him. But don't go anywhere. We got lots more Krista Makes a Podcast coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, I'm sure you've heard us mention the Krista Makes a Podcast supporting cast many times on here, but I'm going to mention it again. Going to KristaMakes.com and signing up for our supporting cast not only allows us to continue making this podcast, but you'll also get bonus episodes of The After Party each week. When you sign up at KristaMakes.com, you'll instantly get access to our entire back catalog, which includes the episode titled Worst Songs Ever, in which Chris and I go through a list of songs we found on the internet, which are supposedly the worst songs ever, although we don't necessarily agree. Here's a clip from that episode.
Sing it to you, Chris. Yeah, we laugh because it's a song about thongs. But have you listened to this song recently?
I have not. No, I'm of course I know this song. I don't. You'd have to be living in a bunker 500 feet below the Earth's core to not have heard this song. But no, I have not listened to it recently. What's up?
The string arrangement in this song is insane and awesome. Like, the production of this song is amazing. And yeah, it's funny. It's about thongs. Whatever. You got to pay attention to the music in this song. The strings in this song, which are performed by violinist Bruce Dukov, are inspired by a strings cover of Eleanor Rigby. And it is absolutely insane. I think this song is kind of a masterpiece, honestly.
Well, I'll have to go back and listen to it. I will tell you off the top of my head, this wouldn't have been one that even probably made my top 100 worst songs, just due to the fact that, you know, especially dance type of music, they're... I hate being cliche here, but the term sex sells. And sex is always going to be a part of music and rock and roll. And talking about the thong and the booty and all that kind of stuff, it sells records. And a lot of times it can be really fun. This isn't something that I ever find myself driving down the road listening to, but I would not consider this a worse song.
Dude, and it's so funny too, because Cisco, who famously has usually like white or silver hair, claims that the first time he saw a thong, it turned his hair white, kind of like what happened to Charlton Heston in the Ten Commandments, which is really funny.
If you'd like to hear this whole episode, plus a giant back catalog of episodes, plus a new episode each week, plus allow us to continue making Chris DeMakes a podcast, head on over to ChrisDeMakes.com and join our supporting cast. Thanks, everybody.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Chris DeMakes a podcast, email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is a pop punk band from Orlando, Florida called Out of Time, featuring Michael Forbes on vocals, Tony Murphy on bass and vocals, Tony Alessi on the drums, and Justin Robinson on guitar. You can find all their stuff on all the streaming platforms. Here's a snippet of their song, False Start.
This was a false start to a false start. We're bending over backwards. We're up to shore, we're moving forward. It was a false start to a false start.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So, Chris, it was really nice to have our mutual friend Jarrett Reddick back. He was there when we first started the podcast, and I'm glad he can come back after all these years. And, Chris, this is not the first time that we've heard this story of the hit song being the last song written after the completion of the rest of the record.
Yeah, we didn't really get too deep into it, but I could imagine the A&R guy sitting back. He's got all 16 songs. He's listening. He likes the record, you know, thinks maybe this song could be a second single, or if maybe this ballad could be the third single, but we don't have the first single yet. And then, of course, Girl All the Bad Guys Want happens, and the rest is history.
Yeah, this was a big song, a song that a lot of people remember. You know, a memory I have of this from, like, I don't know, the past 4 or 5 years, I guess 1985 was kind of the song that I always think of being the huge hit for Bowling for Soup. But I was at a party and they had this thing. It was like a power hour, you know, a power hour where you take a drink once every minute for an hour. So they make these things on YouTube where it's like songs of the 2000s or whatever, and a new song. Every time the song changes to a different music video, you take a drink. And I remember Girl All the Bad Guys Want came on. I'm like, oh my God, there they are. And I guess I didn't realize how big this song really was.
Oh, yeah. Well, I told Jarrett my timeline was a little off. I went back and I'm researching, and I thought these two songs, 85 and Girl All the Bad Guys Want, were from the same record. But Girls from Drunk Enough to Dance in 02, and then A Hangover You Don't Deserve followed 2 years later. But in the timeline of it all, and this song was massive. And I told Jarrett, when you look out in the audience, you know, there's nights when this gets as good or a better reaction than 85. Big song.
It's funny that I think I hear the song more now than I did back when it came out and was on the radio and stuff, because you say this a lot. Sometimes you say this about like the mid-90s. I might say this about the early 2000s. I wasn't real tuned into what was on the radio at that point. I think I'm more tuned into it now than I was then. That was kind of like a blind spot for me. But yeah, it's really cool to hear all these stories. They went to the Grammys. If Joan Rivers is making fun of you, you know that you made it. It's almost like how they say if Weird Al parodies your song, you made it. It's kind of like if Joan Rivers is talking shit, you know you're doing something right, right?
Yeah, I thought that was great. I had read that, but you know, how many late nights I've stayed up with that guy talking about everything from, you know, heavy metal to whatever. Never came across the Joan Rivers story. Made me giggle.
Yeah, hey, I really like the quote, and I think one of those things I always want to think about. Making records is easy and fun. Why shouldn't it be? If it's not, why are you doing it? I mean, at least the fun part. I know every part of it isn't easy. Sometimes you might get frustrated because you're trying to play the same part over and over and you keep messing it up. I know we've all been there. But the fun part should always be there. If it's not fun, what are you doing?
Well, I mean, it reminds me of when Rachel from Skid Row was on talking about they were out and they hit a wall in the studio one day. And the engineer producer, Michael Wagner's like, let's go jet skiing. They just took the whole day off. They went jet skiing. Had to get away for a second, clear your mind, because yes, it's supposed to be fun. That does come across in the recording for sure.
Yeah. You're getting in a room with your friends. You're being creative. You're playing instruments. You're in a freaking rock band. This should be like Christmas morning every time you wake up to go to the studio. And I'm sure anybody who's in a band has had the experience of like waking up feeling like, either frustrated or whatever. But sometimes you just got to remind yourself, this is supposed to be fun. This is fun. Practice is fun. Recording is fun. Don't forget that. You'll hear it in the music if you do.
Mm-hmm. And something that's not lost on Jarrett, sometimes you have to just think of the stars aligning. And I think that the stars align for both Bowling for Soup and Butch Walker. I think that this collaboration had to happen. Had it not, who knows, we'd be talking about Bowling for Soup and Butch in the same light. It's not a knock against either one of them, but this is the song that kind of catapulted both of them to be where they're at today.
It's wild to think about how everything has to happen exactly as it happened. I'm talking from the people getting together to start a band, maybe when they're teenagers, to meeting someone along the way, to someone seeing that band and signing them to a record label, to getting in that room and creating that song that becomes a hit. If one thing along the way is changed or doesn't happen or happens differently, that song is not a hit song.
Oh, absolutely. I think if I start thinking about this stuff for too long, I'll drive myself nuts. You know, what if Roger went to the University of Miami and not, you know, University of Florida? Would I be sitting here talking to right. you? Would I have known Punchline? And that's a crazy, crazy thoughts. I'll tell you another crazy thought, Chris.
What's that?
That we, outside of this wonderful podcast, we also have a supporting cast, which is our version of Patreon. And that's where you can get bonus episodes of the After Party at chrisdemakes.com. You can sign up for our supporting cast and hear Chris and I talk even more than we're talking to you right now.
We can really go down the path of how we ended up here and how we've made hundreds and hundreds of episodes of podcasts together. It's all because, I don't know, 20 some years ago, my little band opened for your big band in Florida somewhere. And now, look, here we are. We're along this path. We make two podcasts together. Krista Makes a Podcast and The After Party, which you can subscribe to at KristaMakes.com.
That's right. And thanks to everybody out there that listens to this podcast. Everybody that is part of our supporting cast, thank you for making the podcast you know and love continue to truck down the road. We appreciate all of your support. And follow Chris Fafalius on Instagram and follow me, Less Than Chris D, on Instagram. We also have a Krista Makes a Podcast Instagram page now. Lots of cool content being thrown up there, as well as the Krista Makes official YouTube page. Lots of great content. Chris is constantly in there putting cool stuff up.
I love content.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't love content? And I want to thank this week's repeat guest. Yes, we've had him here before. My good friend from Bowling for Soup, Mr. Jarrett Ray Reddick. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, everybody. Satan here. I know what you're thinking. Jesus Christ, Satan has a podcast now too? No, no, that's not it. But I am here to tell you about a podcast, and it's one that's all about my favorite band, Punchline. Not the band you expected me to say, right? You probably figured I'd like Slayer, or maybe some backwards Beatles records or something. Those are okay, but you usually find me rocking out to fan-favorite Punchline albums like Action or Lion while I'm torturing dead people for all of eternity. Baby, I know where you are. Punchline's podcast is called A Band Called Punchline, and it's super entertaining to listen to this documentary-style look back at the 25 years of my favorite band. Honestly, I'm really feeling like I'm getting to know these guys, and their story is amazing. I'm so ready for them to get down here. I have so many questions. I gotta give them credit for catching on to my whole 37 thing, too. There's a reason why they're my favorite band, and if you listen to their podcast, they might become yours, too. A Band Called Punchline is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Check it out, and I'll see you all in hell.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.